we need you to fail. And in that failure, we make this platform smarter. And by making the platform smarter, we achieve more of the mission, more impact.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. And we're delighted to be joined by Noah Rabinowitz.
Good to be here. Really exciting. Thank you.
So welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast. I'd love it if you could just start off, maybe take us through your career journey. How did you end up as CLO at Moderna?
Yeah, so I've had an interesting career because I've kind of had equal parts consulting, equal part internal. And I really feel like that has, for me personally, been a real benefit. I don't think you can really be successful on either side if you haven't sat on the other side of the desk.
So Moderna, I think you've had an incredible opportunity there. From our previous conversations, you've shared with me how the approach that you've taken at Moderna was around building a digital-first company. And I guess I think we all are aware of Moderna through the impact it's had over the last few years during COVID, but it's undergone huge scaling rapidly. So I'd love to hear, I guess, a little bit more on what that digital first means. What your experience of being there in a super startup to scale.
So Moderna is an interesting company in that pre-pandemic, it was a research company. It wasn't yet a commercial company the way you would think of most biotechnology or pharmaceutical companies. Didn't actually have a product in the marketplace. And so obviously the pandemic altered the course of history in many ways for the company, and many things that including government intervention and a number of accelerators because of the global health crisis caused the company to enter a new stage that maybe following its previous trajectory would have taken longer. And so most companies grow on sort of a fairly linear curve. This kind of caused an exponential curve in some ways. And so the company entered a completely new phase, a completely new chapter, but hadn't gone through the stages of scale that most typical companies do. I mean, there's companies that take hundreds of years to sort of find themselves at today's current state of evolution. Ours happened in some ways overnight. And so when you think about digitizing everywhere, I mean, again, going back to my consulting time, you know, digital transformation is a product that consultants sell, right? And essentially what it is it's you built it wrong or you built it manually. Now let's digitize it. And so we're trying to learn in some ways from that and say, why not digitize first and think AI and digital first as we're building the organization? Because we have that opportunity to be building. We're thinking about the infrastructure of the company, the underlying systems, the processes. And we want to build it digital first so as not to later on have a number of disjointed, fragmented, disconnected, manual processes that need to be transformed into their next digital chapter. That's really what digital first and AI first mean for us.
Which is super fascinating. I can't imagine there's many companies that, I can't think of any companies that have had a scale build going digital first. Where did you start, I guess?
It starts with people, and it starts with setting it as one of our mindsets, which is, there's a tendency of people to go to the short term. And the short term could look like, I need more resources, I need more people, I need more heads, I need to just start creating value right away. So, What's right in front of you is you can build a new Excel sheet or a smart sheet or put a project plan together and you can hire 5 or 6 or 10 people and hit the ground running tomorrow. And where we try to start is to say, hold on, just hit the pause button for just a second and think about what this would look like if you were to go digital first. How would you build this differently? and what would be your different resourcing needs, your different processes, your different systems. Try to build this with the best version, the most efficient version of the company, the most scalable version of the company first.
You're taking a kind of design approach, you know, looking to where you wanted to get and then working backwards from that, which is amazing. I wanted to ask about the drama of it. When you were in this massive change of the transition, the transformation that was happening, everybody's traumatized in some way because of the pandemic. You've got the drama of the change required in the business. What did you guys learn about dealing with that massive transformation very quickly?
So our 12 Moderna mindsets, what we call them, our ways of operating and ways of thinking, were born out of the pandemic. So for, you know, 9 or 10 years of the company's history, there wasn't a codified way of talking about our, what we call our operating system or the code to our culture, which are our 12 mindsets. By the way, as an aside, we always get this comment from people that say, 12, that's way too many. and our response to it is 12 is the number we've chosen, and there's a reason for it. It would be like walking into a kitchen and saying, you have too many ingredients. Well, that's what I need to...
Too many pots.
Yeah, exactly. So we have 12.
And what are they?
I can give you a few of them. So, for example, one of them is pursuing options in parallel. And pursuing options in parallel, again, if you think about the mindsets as an operating system, driven by the mission, which is to deliver the greatest impact possible of mRNA medicine. So mission, then drive our operating system through the mindsets. Well, if your mission is to impact as many lives as possible, you have to pursue more than one option. Now, that's not a typical business model of many pharma companies, though, because pursuing options in parallel can be expensive. It can also lead to dead ends. But it can also lead to great learning. And so when you have multiple options that you are pursuing and possible, it's going to get you, the belief is that it will get you to the mission faster, to that impact faster. So that's one of them. Another one is acting with urgency. And acting with urgency, obviously during the pandemic, acting with urgency was, it was clear why one would need to act with urgency. Every day, people were dying. And there were family members locked up in their homes, people with underlying health conditions, autoimmune problems, that couldn't even leave their homes. And so you could see why during a pandemic you would act with urgency. But the mission continues. And the belief is that mRNA medicine can have a huge impact on human health. And so acting with that urgency is about driving with purpose. Driving, and you know, as pharma companies, the typical pharma company, the sort of the legacy pharma company, there are some that, as they become layered and bureaucratic, lose that sense of urgency. And so we're saying we don't ever want to lose that urgency. We don't ever want to become average or another player in a very big market. And you know, average in a great industry is still good. But average is average, right?
Sounds like, Noah, you're very much, well, we would say building a culture of curiosity. Would you say Moderna is a curious organization?
Absolutely. So that operating system that I talked about is driven by the mission. It's underpinned by our values. And then the operating system, or the way we operate, the way we activate the values, is through the mindset. So that one of the values is curiosity. So we have that in common. And it is a learning culture, and it's a platform-based company. So another one of the mindsets is prioritize the platform. And what that really means is that the mRNA technology, the science of the platform itself, takes priority over any given product.
Why is that important? To do that,
it's important because the basic premise, if you think about, for example, just to use an analogy, Apple, the Apple iPhone, the device itself, and the operating system that rides on the is infinitely more value than any single app that you can install. And you can personalize the Apple experience not through the device. You don't actually get the opportunity to do anything with the device or the iOS, but you can personalize it through the applications that you put on your phone. it's the same basic idea with mRNA, that the underlying platform has the ability to deal with many, many, many diseases, and that final application, you know, can ride on top of the platform itself. And so the possibilities are huge. If there is a platform technology and science and delivery system that can go after respiratory, that can go after cancer, that can go after autoimmune, that can go after rare disease, you can start to see the possibilities. And so that's why you prioritize the platform. And again, it's different than many of the traditional pharma industries, because they are prioritizing in many ways product.
Just a quick clarifying question. So for anyone listening who's not familiar with mRNA, could you do a quick 20 seconds? What is mRNA?
Sure. mRNA is messenger RNA, and it is essentially the body's information molecule. And it is a way to instruct your body to create proteins that can have an effect upon certain disease states. And so, the underlying concept of the platform itself is that your body is able to produce its own medicine, and it just needs instructions on how to do so. So messenger RNA is that technology that can deliver the information to your body to instruct it to produce medicine.
And that's why it's a platform, because the messenger RNA, you can encode that with any information that produces a protein for any number of illnesses. And as you say,
correct,
it will produce a protein for whatever messenger, and it will produce a protein for whichever illness state you're trying to eradicate. It is amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's like the future is already here, if you know what I mean.
It's, yeah. Sometimes I pinch myself and say, you know, is this science fiction? And then I'm like, no, this is real.
Noah is Vice President and Global Head of Learning at Moderna. He's a global leadership and learning executive, and he focuses on transformational change, digital, agile, and problem-based leadership development. He's very much an expert in the L&D space. He's leading talent and learning professionals and creating lasting programs that go beyond the traditional methods of learning and development. Before joining Moderna, Noah held leading L&D and HR roles in organizations such as Intel, Deloitte, Korn Ferry, and Lucent.
Noah, I'd like to come back to something you said about pursuing options in parallel. I love that. And when you say that, the word that jumps into my head is experimentation. And as you said, when you do that, then you are going to be in a world where things are going to go wrong. We're going to go down some blind alleys and have to come back. How does Moderna deal with essentially these failure, getting things wrong, having to turn around and try something else? Because this must be at the heart of, you know, a culture that can move fast and try things.
Failure is actually, it's not even that it's tolerated. Failure is expected. Failure is necessary because, again, going back to the platform, the objective is to make the platform smarter. The smarter the platform gets, the more effective it can be. And the only way for it to get smarter is to learn what works and what doesn't work. Both of those things have equal validity and equal impact. So it's not even that failure is tolerated, or that, you know, some people say we celebrate failure, kind of like code for, well, it's okay, you know, get up and dust yourself off. It's like, no, we need you to fail. And in that failure, we make this platform smarter. And by making the platform smarter, we achieve more of the mission, more impact.
So the experiments are providing more inputs to the platform, educating it, making it better.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
And a follow-up question on that, Noah. So how in practice do you do that? Because the notion of encouraging people to try things and fail sounds logical, but we have an inbuilt human instinct to avoid, or at least many of us do, to try and avoid failure, and a danger that we, when we do fail, we don't want others to know about it. How practically have you actually managed to overcome that? And it sounds like you have overcome it, so I'd love to know.
I don't know if we've overcome it, but again, if you build with the end in mind, so I'll go back to my consulting days. I have seen so many companies that are paying the price for a fear of failure. I mean, and I'm talking big misses, technology misses, execution misses. And when they peel back the onion and diagnose what was the root cause of this operational or execution failure, it was that somebody knew something and was so afraid to either fail or say something that it got bottled up, and the people up at the top weren't close enough to it, and the people at the bottom were so scared of saying anything, so that it just went for years in some cases. And we know what happens when you neglect something for years. It just gets worse and it festers, and we're trying to not become that organization. And it's hard, because that's all about creating the right culture where people feel like they can speak up at any given time, where you can have real debate. I mean, I'm talking real debate, not nice debate, not kind debate, but respectful but vigorous debate. We also tell people that it's okay to escalate. You know, the typical of, I got to go through my boss to go to his bosses or her boss, and then there's a chain of command. And sometimes you go, what purpose is this chain of command serving other than people being knowing about something a little bit before somebody else knows about something? Like, really, what's the point? And so we don't necessarily apply consequences to people that escalate. We kind of see that as a good thing. Okay, you know something, you're not getting what you need in one place, go somewhere else. We're also trying to keep the organization as lean as possible, which is a challenge when you're growing. Spans and layers emerge, but we are trying to keep a wide span of control.
I'm fascinated by your encouragement of robust debate and serious debate. We have a chapter in our book about criticality, which we thought being critical and being free and having psychological safety, where you're able to be critical of your experiments and be critical of what you're learning, not in a way that damages yourself or damages what you're learning. And we certainly don't encourage people to be critical of others. We suggest people be critical of the model or be critical of what they're trying to deal with objectively, and then work with others to be critical together about, let's remind ourselves what the outcome is. But that idea that there is safety and permission, and the idea of hierarchy is out of the window. It doesn't matter, in service of the mission, is what I hear you saying. I have two questions about that. How do you create psychological safety in the organization, and how is learning linked to all of this?
So another one of our Moderna mindsets is obsess over learning. And we talked a lot about the learning on the scientific side to really make sure that the platform is learning, but we have an equal obsession on the organizational side. We see innovation taking place both in our science and in our manufacturing, but also in the way we organize and operate. And there's a lot of norms, I think, that we have seen that we don't want to subscribe to. And so learning is another essential part of our operating system. We call it obsessing over learning. And I'm not sure we've got it perfectly figured out of how to do this. But the industry, the pharma industry, is known for some of the things that entrepreneurial companies and biotech startups try to avoid. But they also kind of resign themselves to someday, if everything goes the way we want it to and we scale, we'll become that too. And that's okay. So it's a little bit of a paradox of you have to scale and grow to achieve the mission. And our CEO frequently says, you know, someday everybody in this company will know somebody that could benefit from one of our products. And that personalizes it and makes the mission real for people if they haven't already either experienced that themselves. But knowing about the mission that you are working towards and how learning is a way to get there, just the same way that urgency is, the same way as another one of our mindsets, pivot fearlessly in the face of new data. We will not stay on a course if it's the wrong course and all the data is telling us it's the wrong course. There are similar, you can read all these business school case studies that will tell you about companies that stayed the course way too long, even when they had a ton of data that was telling them they need to pivot. You have to ask why. why would a company stay the course on something that data is telling them is completely wrong? And you have to go, well, is it got something to do with the people? Does it have something to do with politics? Does it have something to do with culture and fear? And 99% of the time, the answer is yes.
I want to pick up on that point about the people, Noah. So you're working in a really fast-moving organization that has got experimentation at its core. You describe almost the entire organization as a platform-based business that is constantly learning. How do you prepare the people that are working there for the future? With all the change that's going on around them and the technology that's changing their lives and the way they work, what are you focused on to prepare them for the future?
So there's kind of two ways of handling that, although that's a really tough question.
Yep.
So one way is to try not to create systems and institutions that can't be unraveled. So that's really what we mean by building digital first, is build with the end in mind, because we do have that privilege of building our company as we scale it. And so you have to be really thoughtful and apply design principles to what you want to build and say, is this going to create me some kind of bigger problem down the road that then I'll need to transform? It, you know, so that's one. The other is to help people see the future. And we have a lot of different ways of doing that. Obviously, like many companies, AI is huge and central to that for us. So we have an AI Academy. The AI Academy is the entire kind of school of learning around AI. We have an AI awareness program, which is for every person in the company that introduces them to AI, regardless of what function they're in, introduces them to AI, helps them understand how to build an AI use case. So wherever you're working, finance, manufacturing, supply chain, clinical development, whatever it might be, we want you to learn how to identify opportunities for artificial intelligence. On top of that, we have what we call our applied level, which is more hands-on, using coding tools or low-code, no-code tools to actually start writing AI programming. We have a data visualization program, data prep program. We do AI for our senior leaders. We do AI for our managers. We have an AI speaker series. So we are just like swarming on AI. Yeah.
Super pragmatic. You're centralizing, as you say, people's learning around what is clearly the next big thing, and helping people get their heads around it and give them real skills, it sounds like, as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's been a big, big investment for us in AI, and it's ongoing. I mean, we're not there yet, but it really is about kind of putting a stake in the ground and saying, this is going to be an essential part of our future. Let's start building these skills now.
I'm curious to know what results you've seen from that approach as well, as my expectation is probably you've seen a whole load of practical things actually come out of that, of where people have experimented, learned the skills, but done it in a way that's actually driving through to results.
The programs themselves are built around AI use cases. And so the use case being an opportunity to apply artificial intelligence to some business process or somewhere in our business. And so by definition, the learning is producing a backlog of ideas for us that we then move through a funnel. And those ideas could be everything from how we do kitting in the manufacturing area, to research processes, to biostatistics, to the way we manage our financials, to supply chain predictive analytics. There are so many areas, and so it is practical learning that takes action, that helps people say, you can, because AI can be so, people can be start to believe like AI is just generating fun paintings or having an avatar read a script on a video, but it's way, way, way more than that. And for a business that is trying to build AI first, again, trying to build with AI at the core of the business rather than, again, AI transformation, which is where you're taking a legacy business with legacy processes and introducing AI, that's really, really hard. That is really, really hard. And it causes you to have to unravel years and years of process and systems to then reinstall a new operating system. We're trying to learn how to do that as an organization together. 4,000 people learning how to do that kind of simultaneously as we do it, which is, again, not an easy way to learn, but I think when you do it that way, you can see a bigger impact.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
Noah, you spent a couple of years at Intel, at least. Clearly one of the companies driving acceleration of technology. What's your view on some of the, while we talk about AI, what's your view on some of the latest developments we're seeing? ChatGPT, Bard, for what it will. What are you seeing the impact of those? And what sort of new business models are you seeing? I'm obsessing at the moment that these things are going to create completely new business models, just like mobile created Uber and these sort of mobile-based service organizations. What's your view on the latest developments?
It's interesting because we just recently had our senior leaders came together, and we did an entire day, all of our senior leaders, on the topic of AI. And we looked at a few case studies. We had some professors that came in and helped us look at a few case studies of some AI first companies and what their business models actually look like. And what you realize is that if you build AI at the core of the company, not around the edges and not retrofitting it into legacy processes and systems, if you actually put it at the core first, you can create a completely different business model. We looked at one company in the financial services space that was able to essentially generate, I think, more than 40 lines of business off of a common core at the center, you know, an AI-enabled core. So
it's like exponential. Creates exponential.
It's like exponential. Exactly. It's like exponential. And guess what? That is a platform strategy. And if you look at all the companies that are the most valued companies on the planet, essentially, they're platform companies. They are creating a platform at the center on which everything can emanate. Everything can ride off of that platform. So the business models of the future, I think, will look at it that way and say, we have to build at the center an AI engine that can power everything we do, right? Which is very different than, I think, where we might be headed unless we're careful, which is retrofitting AI onto legacy processes and systems. And I honestly don't know what the value of doing that is. Sometimes I think it might not have the ROI that we think.
What about from a learning perspective? So are you exploring AI tools in the context of how you approach learning? You talked about how you build AI skills using learning, but what about within your learning team? Is there any way that you're also applying those same principles to how you approach learning?
We are. I think it's, although sometimes I feel like we're focused more more on our customers and their AI learning journey than our own. We are doing some experimentation. We're using generative AI to do video creation. I mean, video is so core to a learning function. And to be able to not have to bring in a studio crew every time you want to build a video and to be able to write a script and boom, you know, 7 minutes later, you've got a really nice looking AI generated tutorial. That's something that we've been experimenting with quite a bit. We also have a learning experience platform, which has got an AI-driven recommendation model in it. And so we're really working hard to personalize learning for people so that they kind of are presented with something that they didn't even know they were interested in, but the algorithms are finding their interests and their skills, the skills they want to build. And then pulling from the vast libraries of content, both content that's been created inside our company as well as that we're buying through different content libraries to give them good recommendations. We still have to build that habit of people, you know, people check their Snapchat and their Facebook all the time, but we still haven't built the habit of you know, logging in every morning and checking your learning feed. So that's there's still some change work that needs to go on there, but the tools are ready for it.
There's something you referenced earlier around sort of not following the pitfalls that maybe other companies have fallen into. And I know from reading some of your super valuable articles that you share on LinkedIn, you've got some views around sort of leadership development and maybe some of the traditional approaches that we take to leadership development. And you had a very interesting article around, you know, maybe actually we just need to focus on getting 1% better in how we approach some of these. Would love you to share some of your thoughts around some maybe the more traditional approaches and why you've adopted a different view.
Well, again, this is where I can kind of really draw on experience being on both sides, being on the consulting side as well as being a customer of consulting and on the internal side. And, you know, the learning and leadership development industry is massive. I think some people estimate that it's over $40 billion a year. And so it's just this giant industry that has, I'd say, progressively, even over the time that I've been in this space, you know, 20 plus years, I've seen the promises just continue to grow. And this desire for better formulas for, you know, do these five things or do these three things or seven tips for this or a hack for that. Or, you know, I've seen propaganda coming from the leadership development industry that is promising mastery. I mean, I just don't understand how you can promise mastery from taking like a one-day course or reading a book or an article. And so there's no regulation on this. So the hype and the promises continue just to grow and grow and grow. And that's been one of the strategies to differentiate in this very crowded learning and leadership development industry. So as I thought about it, I said, well, what if the promise was just to help somebody get a little bit, a fractional bit better forever, you know, on being on your learning and leadership development journey from the day you start your career to the day you end your career? It's not time bound. It's not event based or episodic. It's a journey that you are going on, like, and maybe after all that time, you might achieve something that could be called mastery, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the 1% better concept, is just like it's meant to sort of challenge this idea of these giant leaps with little bits of work, because in no other space does that really work.
It reminds me of, you said in no other space does that really work. Nothing, you know, I play the piano and I know that if I don't keep on playing every day, things I was masterful at 5 years ago just go away. It is like riding a bike in some way, but you've got to keep at it. You've got to be fresh and you've got to be in it and you've got to be engaged for it to remain mastery. You know, it's like you think it reminds me of the Japanese, you know, where they have masters who are living national treasures, but people want to learn from them. They become part of their studio and they don't try to become masters. They just try to become part of the ecosystem that is masterful. And I love that concept. You talk about mediocrity sometimes. In one of our articles, you talked about why we should reject mediocrity and focus on the commitment to excellence. Why is this so important, do you think?
The corporate world, if you want to generalize, the corporate world or business has created for itself and in some ways a stereotype of Monday. Oh God, it's Monday. I mean, how many people say that? Or thank God it's Friday. I mean, the implication of hating Monday and loving Friday. And also, again, in my consulting days, I had the ability to walk through many different offices, many different company cultures. And I tell people that, you know, I could always get a sense of the culture quickly. You could just feel it in the walls. And a lot of it had to do with, I'd say, just people just riding it out.
Yeah.
Even just looking forward to retirement. And so this idea of rejecting mediocrity as a company is to say, an organization that aspires to be the greatest at what it does, the best, and is willing to put in the work. You know, when we think about this for surgeons, for musicians, like you said, Garrick, for athletes, the idea of working, 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 just driving and finding that inner motivation to become the best version of yourself is not foreign to us. But when we apply that into the business context, we kind of go, what? You know, it's not the same. And you hear people saying it manifests itself in time allocation, because people will say, I don't have time to do that. I'm so consumed with my day job, I don't have time. And we would laugh about that in any other context. If there was a football team that said, we don't have time to practice,
no,
we would say, well, that's absurd. But in our world, we've kind of gotten to that place.
It reminds me of, you talked about surgeons and the way the surgeons build this learning into the process. You know, that famous dictum of watch one, do one, teach one. And that's part of how surgeons learn. They watch a surgery, they do one supervised, and then they teach one. And that just having those three cycles built in everything they do enables learning to be a key part in how quality is built into the game.
In the military as well. I mean, the after action review is built into the game.
Yeah.
Because the stakes are really high. And when you're practicing something, when you're going through an operational practice, the learning actually becomes the most important thing.
That's right.
Because the stakes are really high. And if things go wrong, really bad things can happen. And that's where I take it back to mission. If the mission is the most important thing, if the mission is the true driver of how you behave, then learning doesn't become an afterthought. Learning becomes the primary activity. And what happens, I think, in the corporate world is people can become very removed from the mission. They don't feel that direct personal connection to the mission. And even sometimes they get to the point where they roll their eyes at it, and they see it as something where, oh, that's on the poster on the wall, and you know, that's words, but I live the real reality. And it's nothing like that. And so once that disconnect happens and you're not connected to the mission personally, emotionally, psychologically, then you are just riding it out. You are just going to just try to get through the day.
Drive out mediocrity. I have another question, which is back to the beginning. You said you had 12 mindsets, and 12 was not an arbitrary number, which is what you said. Some people, everybody says it's too many, but no, you have 12. Why 12?
I think 12, it was not by design, it was the number that emerged. And so as we really studied the mindsets that drive our behaviors, our systems, our research, our way of manufacturing, we found 12. And so I don't think it was, and I would encourage, because I've been through competency modeling and capability modeling and skills taxonomies and skill architectures and job architectures, I've been through more of them than you can possibly imagine in my career. And if the person who is facilitating that process starts out and says, we need to find this many and we're limited to this many, the process is flawed from the very beginning.
I think we'd fully agree, Noah. When we were writing the Curious Advantage book, we discovered seven C's of curiosity. We didn't decide there would be seven C's of curiosity. We sort of ended up in that place. Talking back about curiosity and asking yourself, as someone who strikes us, I think, as someone who's absolutely not riding out your time there at Moderna, two things. One, how would you personally define curiosity? And secondly, if you would share, what's something that you're really curious about at the moment, personally?
Just to take one step back, I am definitely not riding anything out. In fact, by some people's standards, they'd say, well, you're kind of at the tail end of your career by like a chronological perspective. And I'm like, okay, yeah, but I'm in the hardest job I've ever had.
Exactly.
So, and I feel like the experiences I gained over these years positioned me to be able to do this job now. And so I'm excited about it.
That's really interesting that you're looking for more challenging roles.
I'm like looking for more challenge. Bring it on. Yeah, I'm like, bring it on. And again, it's driven by the mission because I have a very personal connection to this mission.
Tell us.
I have a very, very personal connection to this mission. I feel it inside of me. It's not a job. It's something that I've just experienced, the pain and suffering of disease personally and through my family. And, you know, I want to do my part to make the world a little bit of a better place. And so here is an organization that has that as its reason for being. And so I can get on board with that. You know, if I was selling chips, I don't think I could. I just couldn't do it. And I'm not trying to, you know, disparage other industries. It's just not for me. But curiosity, it's an obsession with understanding why things are the way they are. And, you know, again, I'll go back to another Moderna mindset. Challenging convention, questioning convention is necessary. It's the way things evolve. Evolution is essential for our well-being and our success. as people. And so the way it was fine, but it can't be the way things will be. Change has to happen. And so curiosity is what allows that to happen. It's the thing that kind of helps us see, maybe this could be different, or maybe I should try it this way, or maybe this is broken, or maybe this dominant logic, you know, like, explain it to me, help me understand why it is the way it is. And what I find a lot of the time is that there's a lot of vested interests in the way things are. It's a lot of vested interests. And so sometimes when you start questioning things, you get a lot of pushback. People start telling you, you know, oh, you're being problematic, you're being troublemaker, you're being contrarian. And yeah, I mean, maybe that's true. I mean, that's fine. I'm okay with that.
I love the way you characterize curiosity as an obsession. When we were doing our research, one of the things we discovered was in the etymology of the word curiosity, one of the meanings came from an ancient Greek understanding of the gadfly that obsessively annoys the cow in the field. And the cow is constantly swishing and trying to get away from the gadfly, who's obsessed with the cow. And that's where one of the words curiosity came from, which we liked very much. What questions do you have for us?
Okay. So maybe we can talk about, I think this conversation has taken us down the road of questioning things and looking for better ways of doing things. And I think those that can come, and I've experienced them personally, with consequences that some people may not want to deal with. Does your research, or did you find anything about a profile or a type of person who may be more comfortable with this, or even just willing to kind of go down these roads versus the person who may just be okay accepting things the way they are?
We had Dr. Diane Hamilton on the podcast, and she had some research that showed the things that get in the way of curiosity. So I guess that sort of goes to build the profile of someone who is more curious. So it was a model around fate. So the F was for fear, the A was for assumptions, the T was for tech, and the E was for environment. So that those were the things that sort of, yeah, through her research, stopped someone from being curious, if it was a personal fear, if it was inherent assumptions that someone held on to, maybe the technology environment around them, or the technology around them, or then the broader environment. And I think the environment comes to the psychological safety and some of those elements that you were describing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Conscious of time, I think we need to start to wrap things up. So
sure.
I mean, what a set of conversations. So if I take us back through some of the things we covered, so took us through a little bit of Moderna's journey, how it as a company thinks AI and digital first, the operating system that you're building there, and how that all ties back to the mission, how you've prioritized the platform. Really interesting to hear around failure is not just tolerated, failure is expected, and failure is seen as necessary. How your own experience, you've seen companies that pay the price for a fear of failure if people aren't too afraid to speak up, and how you're trying not to become that organization. I love your 12 mindsets, or the ones that you shared with us, particularly the obsess over learning. Also how you've seen that there's a lot of norms that you don't want to subscribe to. Also love the pivot fearlessly, and particularly in the face of new danger.
New data.
New data. Well, maybe danger as well.
Danger as well, yeah.
How you've tackled the building skills around AI and your AI Academy, and how you've built ways that people can actually very tangibly apply those AI skills in coming up with new business needs and business ideas. Interested about the discussion on leadership development, and if anyone sees programs that promise mastery in a day, probably appropriate to be skeptical about that. And maybe we just need to focus on getting 1% better. And then if we can actually tie, or if we really truly believe in a mission, then actually learning becomes the primary activity. So covered loads there. If there's one thing for our listeners to take away, Noah, from all of that, what would it be?
I think to really believe that organizations can become an innovation as well. And an organizational innovation that has the freedom to innovate, to think differently, to organize differently, to communicate differently, to meet differently, to invest differently, to do its research and development differently, to use information differently is possible. And, you know, we've gone down this road of the future of work, and it's sort of become all about where people are working. Are they at home? Are they in a cafe? Are they in the office? I just feel like the future of work is so much more than that, that we can really be focused on how we're working and to really think mission first and ask ourselves, what are the optimal or new ways of organizing, meeting, exchanging information, collaborating, designing, communicating that would allow that mission to come true and to fulfill its promise. And so I think we're living that experiment at Moderna. It's a work in progress, like everything is, but I feel like we have the permission here to do that. And it's kind of a really cool, liberating, new feeling, because I for so long in my career and in different roles, whether as a consultant or inside, I got to see places where that permission just was not created, where it was just, there was a million reasons why you couldn't do certain things and they were just off limits. And then you had to ask, well, why? What is the reason for that? And so I just am experiencing a very different context here, and it's pretty cool.
So believe that we can think differently, and in everything we do, look for that way to think differently. Noah, thank you so much for joining us. We're out of time, thank you for sharing all of your ideas.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what have you learned from it. We always appreciate hearing from our listeners and having a curious conversation. So join today at hashtag Curious Advantage. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital, or audio book copy now to further explore the 7Cs model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.